Okay, so part of living in the country, especially in the area that we're in right now, means that we deal with things like cattle. It's totally fine, super cute little moo cows, but currently I am looking at a calf who is on the other side of the fence from all of the other moo cows. And I've just grabbed a thing of cardboard as though that could protect me from the moo cow, but he's more scared of me than I am of him. So currently turned to walk away, and I'm gonna keep walking with him, hope that he goes down to the end of the road where we can open the gate maybe and let him back with his fellows. Yes, moo cow, keep your distance. I appreciate it a lot. Come on. Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Oh no, don't go through that fence. That's barbed wire. That will hurt. Oh honey, no. Oh honey. Unless you can do it. Can you do it? Yes! Nice. Yes. And there, the little moo cow goes running along. That is great. Happy ending. Bye, moo cow.
Well, I was walking one morning for pleasure. I spied a young cowboy just riding along. His hat was thrown back and his spurs were jingling. And as he approached, he was singing this song. Yippee-ti-yi-yo, get along, little dog, is it's your misfortune and none of my own. Yippee-ti-yi-yo, get along, little dog, is you know that Wyoming will be your new home. Now early in spring we'll round up all the doggies, mark 'em and brand 'em and bob off their tails. Round up the horses, load up the chip wagons, and follow the doggies on the lonesome trail. Yippee-ti-yi-yo, get along, little doggies, it's your misfortune and none of my own. Yippee-ti-yi-yo, get along, little doggies, you know that Wyoming will be your new home. No actual doggies were harmed during the production of this song.
You've been on the road for a while. Gosh, when did you leave? A week ago. A little over a week ago. Yeah.
Yeah, a week ago today.
Exactly, yeah. A week ago. Yeah.
This is a fun trip. I've been basically doing my sort of tour of my favorite and most functional co-housing communities on this tour. I was at Songaya in Bothell, Washington, which is just outside of Seattle. And was doing a long weekend of facilitation training with one of my teaching partners of many years. And we just closed out an 8-weekend series with that training with a group of students we've been working with out here for almost 3 years now. And then so finished that up last night and then drove up here to Bellingham, Washington, and am now working with, there's a subgroup here of income sharing folks within this co-housing community, which is a pretty unusual thing. We think there might be one other in the U.S. where there's income sharing happening within co-housing. And this is one of those groups. So I get to work with them and then do a workshop tomorrow in downtown Bellingham on starting an intentional community. So that is the Washington portion of the trip.
What is it that you are facilitating and working people through that's related to their intention to create an income sharing community?
They're doing partial income sharing already. So they're already sharing 5% of their income that's basically going into a shared food system that they've put together. And they are wanting to, you know, their goal is to move toward being a full income sharing group. And they're not quite sure how to do it. I introduced this idea to them about a year and a half ago because the community was struggling with dynamics around like classism and some people just having a really easy time financially and other people struggling with not being able to afford to live here easily. And so, so I plopped this into their space as this sort of radical notion, not necessarily thinking they were actually going to take it up, and they did. And so there's 14 adults in this community that are doing partial income sharing already. And, you know, they've got the same questions that I think every group does when they go into income sharing. You know, how does it work if somebody wants to save money, and is it okay to build equity, and do we own everything together, or is there still a private ownership piece involved, and what does retirement mean in an income sharing group? And so the work that I'm going to be doing with them this afternoon and tomorrow morning is really very nuts and bolts, and helping them sort of think through how do you actually set up this kind of system, and, you know, and how do you have tricky conversations about money with each other? You know, that's a big, you know, it's a big challenge that a lot of income sharing groups have, especially at the beginning when people are not at all used to having financial conversations with people outside of maybe their spouse, who they may already have a hard time talking with about money. It's Bellingham Co-Housing is the co-housing group, and they just call themselves the income share group. They haven't really named themselves beyond that.
It sounds like, you know, one thing people get concerned about is long-term security, and, you know, being able to, you know, to retire, for example, and then also sort of the long-term security of the entire group itself. And, like, what are some of the approaches that that is possible for groups to take?
Well, I mean, there's actually a whole set of kind of intersecting questions there. There's, you know, there's income sharing, you know, putting into a collective pot the money that you're actively making, whether that's, you know, actively produced income through jobs or passive income that comes from investments. So that stuff is all under the category of income sharing. But then there's a bunch of other related questions about money. You know, there's, are you debt sharing? So that's one of the things that the Solidarity Collective has decided to lean into doing, but it's pretty unusual for groups to take on the debts of individual members. And then there's, are you asset sharing? And in some ways, the asset sharing question is the one that makes people the most nervous. And there's good reasons for that, because there's definitely a lot of actual genuine cults out there that insist that people turn over all of their assets to the group. And that can be kind of sketchy ethically. But I think that that's, you know, that's one of the places where if you're income sharing but not asset sharing, it allows people to still have a savings account and, you know, be able to put some money away or not have to turn over all of the things that they've done so far in their lives to create a sense of financial security for themselves long term. Now, of course, that's only really true for people who have been able to do that. And one of the groups of people that income sharing is really appealing for is folks who pretty much have no way in hell of getting past the $500 mark on a savings account ever. And so that the not asset sharing is a security blanket basically for middle class folks, and isn't necessarily something that is going to make that much difference to poor and working class folks in terms of being able to hang on to what you already have. But, you know, there's also a lot of things that you can do, and different groups do things like this differently. But like, for instance, at Eastwind Community, where I lived many years ago, they handle retirement by having a standard contribution expectation each week, which is at Eastwind, when I was there anyway, it was 40 hours a week. And that included income producing labor, things like childcare, cooking, like all the sort of domestic labor. We're all sort of in that 40 hours a week. And then I think it was, and I was young enough at the time that I didn't pay that much attention to it. But I think it is like when you get to be 60, that hour per week requirement goes down by an hour per week per year that you are over the age of 60. And so that's one example of how a group has decided to handle that. And so if somebody's 75, you know, then they're contribution expectation would be a lot lower than somebody who's 30. I don't know that an hour a week is actually the right number, but I think that concept that you can sort of phase people out of labor expectations is one way that groups handle that, that I think is pretty interesting and probably works pretty well for most people as long as you have some other way to take into account things like pregnancy and disabilities of various sorts that would make it harder for folks that aren't just age-based. I think that whole thing is just a really big shift for people. Like, we're very much used to being sort of, you know, every human for themselves kind of a thing. And, you know, and that's not so true when you get into an income sharing situation. You have other people to rely on. And that also requires a certain amount of trust. And people are just genuinely insecure. And it's like, if you're hanging on by a thread, it's hard to conceptualize of letting go of that thread, you know, and, you know, even if you're able to latch onto a much bigger rope by freeing your hand up from the thread. So I think it's just tough for people. Well, I think the number one thing in the training that we do for facilitators is working with people to get to a place where they're just comfortable in the presence of strong emotions and they don't go all deer in the headlights and not know what to do when someone is upset or crying or acting irrationally because they're into territory that's really hard for them to talk about. So I think that's, you know, one of the biggest skills that I think facilitators can develop is just being able to like stay present with people when they're going through something big and that isn't just being able to be sort of like, you know, rationally stated and all that kind of stuff. It's like, you know, we all get insecure sometimes and all have a hard time being present in a conversation. So having the facilitator not check out makes a really big difference to whether groups actually have these conversations successfully or not. Some people are pretty comfortable talking about money, and but then those people are often surprised at like how many people are clustered all the way over at the other end of the spectrum, which is that I am super uncomfortable talking about money at all. And so, you know, being able to develop a sort of repertoire of facilitation tools where you can help folks get into conversations in different ways that isn't just, you know, rip your heart out of your chest and lay it bleeding in the middle of the floor for everybody. Like, I think that's often what open conversations about finances feel like to people. I feel super grateful actually to our group at home because I feel like I'm in just a much better position these days to be holding space for other groups because it's like I know how hard those conversations can be because I'm actually in those conversations myself right now. And I think that it increases my level of compassion and authentic understanding. I'm working with the income share folks here, and then I'm doing a workshop on starting an intentional community in Bellingham tomorrow. Just it's a public event. And then I hop on a train on Wednesday morning and take trains and buses down to Arco Santi, which is another intentional community in Arizona. And I'm going to be there next weekend this weekend. It's actually just a few days from now for a convergence down there. There's a big conference happening down there that I'll be on the program for and getting to learn from other people, which I'm excited about. And then have a day off. And then I've got 3 days of meetings with intentional community movement leaders that are going to be talking how do we big picture strategize cooperative culture development and community development in North America. So I'm excited to get to spend time with 40 of my closest friends who are doing the same kind of stuff all over the place. So, and then I come home. Yay.
We're looking forward to that. We miss you.
I know. I miss you all too.
I mean, yeah. So what I was going to say is that we are facing a fucking Sisyphean task, and the way we can look at it is to either despair in the fact that we're going to push up a fucking boulder and clean up the literal shit that has been left for us to clean up after people, both inside and out, and of this property, and how we're doing it repeatedly, because it is the freaking myth of Sisyphus. We're going to just like keep doing it for a while. But we can either despair in it, or we can take respite in the little moments where things are okay for like a half a second, and you get to play with kitties and notice them being dorks and like persevering, because you like that's the option. That's what we have to do.
I feel like this is what I am telling myself. I feel like the culture of life and the culture of living and the culture of dwelling and co-dwelling that was here before we acquired this place was one of base consumerist accumulation, waste, and kind of death, kind of a culture of, you know, that did not celebrate connection or life or sustainability. And instead was a, you know, sort of a survival cult, you know, without being aware of itself as a survival cult. And, you know, this sort of, I mean, and I think because of that, like, whatever relationship we had with them and whatever we were willing to do just doesn't matter. It just didn't matter because it didn't filter through into that culture of you know, sort of immediacy and emergency and despair and disconnection. There was so much disconnection.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the result. The result is, you know, it's not, we're not responsible for this space really. And so we're not responsible for what we're turning back over to you folks, because we're not really any different. We're just, everyone is either, you know, kind of a hunter or a collector or a, I mean, you know, that's you know, so they, what do they owe us? They don't owe us anything.
I had optimism at the couple of conversations that I had with them, especially when I was open and honest and went to a discomfortable place, like an uncomfortable place of expressing stuff that was very contradictory to what they were saying. And repeatedly, every time they talked to me thereafter, they would talk about how they really liked that conversation and they really benefited from it, and it stimulated that, like, and I don't know. I think it would be something that, like, the permeation of that kind of culture, if you're going to enact actual substantial change, they would have to have been around us and interacted with us for years. Like, it's something that's...
I mean, I don't know if we, you know, I mean, I'm not saying we're better than they
no,
are.
No,
I'm
not saying that either. I don't mean to...
That
might have accidentally implied that.
That I feel no care. I don't feel any care in any of the disposition of all of this. Like, I don't feel like there was care on their part in terms of, you know, of... you know, even just sort of telling us what, you know, the, you know, what it was going to look like when they left, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, because, well, I don't know. I don't know how much this is, I don't know how helpful this is. I'm pissed off.
Mm-hmm. Because honestly, if they had mentioned, like, hey, we're struggling, hey, we could not get all of this shit together in the time to leave in the appropriate amount, and like if a person has already paid for their time here, like we recognize we have to get out or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like there could have been a different reality that we walked into.
Mm-hmm.
That was more honest and that was maybe a
little less just super deceptively gaslighting, because to tell us that you're staying another day to not leave the place nasty,
mm-hmm.
and then leave literal shit for us to clean up. Literal, like, what? By what definition do you have of nasty?
Yeah.
So, back to the thing I was really saying, like, I think we can find maybe a space to laugh about the absurdity, because that's what I got.
So I just want to describe, I just want to sort of walk through and describe. There's garbage, you know, garbage cans are, the garbage container is full, but there's also a bunch of garbage sacks, and then there's garbage pretty much on the floor, not tons of it, you know, but a lot of things just left on the floor. Everything's left in the cupboards, you know, so there's nothing's wiped down at all. It really feels like, there's, you know, there's stuff all scattered around the counters, there's stuff scattered on the kitchen table, there's empty cans and empty cigarette packs and ashtrays full of cigarette butts, and there's a litter box full of cat poop in the living room, so they didn't even dump the litter box as they left. There's a bunch of plastic spoons and forks and stuff in the little wrappers still. Another ashtray, fast food containers, bunches of fast food containers.
And then just stuff, like even a family photo album.
Yeah, they left a family photo. And then a bunch of nice things like candelabras and
space heaters,
and so there's a bunch of, you know, there's,
I might actually be able to use this for the kittens
to
get them to the vet.
There's things of value, all the furniture.
But then I'll just like the stuff, like why I and the light. I don't know if that's clean, because that looks like dirt to me.
I just want them to know, if they are listening, if you did this because you thought that we thought we were better than you in some way, like, I think we really actually fucking went out of our way to assure you that we did not think that, and that we never asked little of anything of you or tried to impose anything at all on you. Like, we are not better than you. We don't have more money than you. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Something with this area too, like candle. There's like candle wax or paint or something all along these hardwood floors.
Well, there we go. Okay. And a super dusty vacuum.
More cigarettes and cigarette butts.
I think that's paint. On the floor. I think this is what, so this is actually from the previous iteration, though, because I think this is the stuff, the carpet that...
More TV screens, though.
That she pulled up.
Figure that out. Stuff.
Mm-hmm. And more stuff, and...
Yeah, just like thousands of little knickknacks of different kinds and things.
Hey, hangers. Free hangers. There's a map thing.
Yeah, I saw it's next to the staff.
Oh, yeah.
So who knows? What's that? What that's all about? I would figure they would take the map with them on their mystical journey.
This is the way to the pantry?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's sealed.
Yep, yep.
I mean, this is just a door that goes nowhere. I guess a door that goes out.
Side?
Outside.
To...
It just never opened because there was like a couch in front of it.
Ah.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I think that... Oh, and then this needs to be not like that. And that is very easily openable.
Yeah. All right. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm done.
Mm-hmm. I'm taking out some hangers. There will be that much less. Okay. How... This is awesome. Now putting some cushions in front of the door in some futile hope.
Anyway, let's find ways to laugh about it.
As they say in 10 Things I Hate About You, we're screwed. Hey, I don't want to hear that defeatist attitude. Let's hear you upbeat. We're screwed!
We're screwed!
Yeah! Like,
put me in, coach!
Yeah, okay. Okay. Night, y'all.
Bunch of cows outside, and one of them is just making a ton of noise, and I don't know if it's picking up on Deep Blue or whatever our microphone's name is. It just brings to mind anarchism. You have one noisy cow. No, I mean, I just have two. Because I think all of our ideology is reducible to jokes about cows.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You have a cow which does not want to be. Which is no longer wants to be violently coerced by the state.
Yeah. Right, right. Angrycommie.wordpress.com is Gibran's blog, and the essay is Why Anarchism, or it's really not really an essay, it's a kind of a medium-sized, well, it's, you know, it's a
1,500 words.
It's a 1,500 word post on, in pretty plain language, on why Gibran is an anarchist. And I would preface this discussion by saying that, you know, we've talked a lot about how we all have very much the same orientation toward capitalism in our community or in our organization, which is we want to move away from it. We want to find new ways of sharing and creating and producing and distributing. And I feel like we're in allyship with a lot of different groups and a lot of different theoretical tendencies in that way, that we're sort of ecumenical, socialistic, you know, people. But Gibran, you know, pretty strongly identifies as an anarchist. And this essay is your attempt to kind of talk about what that means.
So because I wrote this, I kind of would almost like you to take the lead on this, Matt, and talk about what parts about this you want to like engage with.
I really just want to ask one question, but it's a pretty broad question. It has to do with the paragraph that is or that ends a class of bureaucrats. Anarchists are skeptical of the communist position that you can take over the state. It'll eventually wither away. Theoretically, anarchists would contend that the very existence of a state is predicated on, at the very least, a division between those with active positions within it and those without. A class of bureaucrats can turn out to be just as oppressive as a class of property owners if those bureaucrats have enough power. So there's a lot there, but if those bureaucrats have enough power, is administrative power equivalent to the power of private property? Can you say, you know, either historically or, you know, just logically, you know, what is it that makes you feel like those types of power are analogous.
Yeah. So I think, okay, I think there are a couple of ways to break this down. One is to say, first of all, that historically, it's very common for administrative power to turn into private property, right? To administrative control of resources and property to turn into private control. You see this pretty frequently, right? In like, I mean, most regimes are pretty corrupt, right? But like, to take one that I find fascinating as an example, like Libya, on one hand, Colonel Gaddafi's state was in some ways quite redistributive, right? There was a major effort made to spread the oil money, the Libyan oil money around. And at the same time, Gaddafi and people close to him accumulated a staggering amount of personal wealth, right? Through the process of administering the natural resources of this country, right? So to begin with, A, I think we have to consider that, right? Within a state, it is not uncommon for that administrative power to turn into private power. On the other hand, I think if we consider what private property really is, right, it is the sole right to administer that property, right? That's sort of how we conceive of it.
Absolutely. The first thing that you really learn about property as a legal concept is that it really is sort of relational in nature. The power over property and the ownerships, the quote-unquote ownership of property, is absolutely relational.
Yeah, and so as a result, if that power is in many ways very directly analogous, right? The ability to administer resources versus ownership of resources. Like, they have different connotations, and there can be very big meaningful differences, but in a system where the state is essentially trying to centrally manage all of the resources of a nation, I think those things become very similar. Mm-hmm. They become.
But you're not. I mean, but the Marxist would say, but you know, the point about property ownership is that it is you use it to generate surplus value. So then you would then have to say, well, what is analogous in this administrative power that analogous to generating surplus value?
Yeah, and absolutely. And I would say, A, well, there is the generation of surplus value, right? Like when a state, like, I mean, the Soviet Union was very much so a development-oriented state. They were interested in producing more and more value, right? And it's surplus value is kind of, I think, kind of the potentially contentious point here, right? It is the question of who ultimately gets that value, right? Mm-hmm. Is it the people who are producing it? Is it the people in general? Or is it, you know, this private entity? But bureaucratically, right, if you have this property under the control of a elite bureaucracy, they are going to continue to accumulate those resources, right? Bureaucracies tend to want to expand. Bureaucracies as entities seek expansion, right?
Aren't you giving some sort of metaphysical power to bureaucracy, whereas the Marxist explanation is that that bureaucracy in a class-divided society is empowered by class rule. In a society that has eliminated class rule, then what is this mysterious energy that makes a bureaucracy, like this Nietzschean sort of bureaucracy argument that you're making?
Well, I mean, the answer is that I think that's begging the question, right? That the to say, oh, well, you can have a bureaucratic society that's eliminated class, I think is begging the question. That assumes, in fact, that you can already do that, right? Like, to make that claim, you have to assume that state has already somehow abolished class. And if we look mm-hmm. at actually, like, existing, you know, socialist and communist countries, bureaucracies take up the function of a class, right, in them. They hoard resources. They limit membership. They, you know, hold on to power. They hoard these things.
They have tremendous informational power, which I guess is also part of that equation, right?
Absolutely. Informational power, administrative power, and violent coercive power as well, right? And so I am not giving bureaucracies any more abstract metaphysical power than Marx gives to class, right? The bureaucracy is the class, right, in this conception. In a state where so private property has been abolished and the bureaucracy manages all of the property, the bureaucracy is a class. And unless there are genuinely no boundaries to entry to the bureaucracy, which again, that just doesn't happen, right? Bureaucracies are sort of by design technocratic, they're elite. You have to, pass certain exams, or you have to know certain people, or usually both, right, to enter them. They are not institutions that are open to everyone by necessity, right? And if they are, if the state apparatus is identical with the entire the entire body of everyone governed, then at what point do you even meaningfully have a state, right? Like,
at that point, you have a participatory body of some kind that has obviously managed to bypass or transcend the types of limitations that you're talking about anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think one of the key critiques and problems that anarchists have to deal with is this question of, well, what constitutes a state, right? What if we say we're opposed to the we support the deconstruction or abolition of state power, what exactly does that mean? And I think the answer is, well, there isn't a fine, clear dividing line between state and non-state entities, right? Like, at what point does a militia become a government, for instance? This is sort of like, it's the whole classical, like, philosophical question of, like, well, when does a grain of sand, if you keep adding grains, become a mound?
No, I thought about those questions and promptly, thought I shouldn't bother necessarily asking them. But, I think for some people, particularly right libertarians, mm-hmm. I do want to ask the question, what is it that you think collective power is? And what do you think the state is? And why wouldn't a truly democratic state serve the same function in your sort of libertarian vision as a group of people, through consent and proactive agreement are coming together to govern and make policies? I mean, it seems like I think that is a thin membrane. It just seems like your criticism comes from a different direction.
Oh, absolutely. And so that's one of the things I make clear here, is that the anarchist tradition is very diverse, right? On one hand, you've got radical individualists, people like Stirner. Like, you have people who some anarchists who really would reject any sort of collective decision-making body. Those people are in a minority, though. Most anarchists believe in collective decision-making. What they want, though, is to remove sort of the coercive, violent element of the state from, cooperative decision making, right? And
they seem to recognize that the antecedent to, or the cause of that violent coercion is a kind of material inequality of power that the state tends to accumulate in a manner that, you're saying is kind of similar to the way in which capitalists accumulate power.
Absolutely. And I actually wrote something here, not in the blog post itself, but on Facebook in response to someone that I think is worth reading.
Right.
Someone asks, Steve Parsons asks, I'm somewhat confused here. This seems like a critique and not a prescription. And the language is rather similar to libertarians, the violent coercion, for example. What actually are you proposing aside from critiques of the state? So I respond, libertarians ripped off a lot of their language from earlier anarchists, so the two have some surface level similarities. As far as me proposing a critique rather than a prescription, you're absolutely right. There are specific courses of action that are implied by the critique, such as weakening and hopefully eventually abolishing the police and military. This is really meant as a very brief... This is the important part, though. I shared some of my own views, but tried to keep it general to anti-capitalist anarchists. For left anarchists, the existence of social and material hierarchies are mutually sustaining in relationship to the violent capacity of the state, right? And I think this is the core moment where anarchist thought kind of diverges from communist thought. And it's not that they totally disagree on this point. It's that the anarchist really emphasizes this in their critiques, right? This is a framework that emphasizes this point, that these two things are mutually reinforcing. So, for instance, despite being an anarchist, I would 100% support a national like health care system, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. absolutely expand the state in that way. But a national health care system enables people to resist those violently coercive mm-hmm. hierarchical elements of the state.
It also enables a huge bureaucracy, though.
Absolutely. And I think there is a very big difference between a militarized bureaucracy and a non-militarized one, right? There's a big difference between giving bureaucrats guns or control of people with guns and not.
This is like where you say in your post that you are sort of an anarchist living in a sort of pluralistic world.
Absolutely. And one of the things I say is that I'm not sure that from this point in time, the absolute abolition of the state is even possible, right? And I think you can admit that and say at the same time, the anarchist critique has an enormous amount of potential value, right? That we don't even have to necessarily be able to abolish the state to get something from the anarchist tradition. I'm very non-dogmatic and non-sectarian. Like, I will fight with people all day about these critiques, but I don't insist that anyone else, you know, become an anarchist, right? I'm not going to be like, oh, you're a communist. Like, I won't work with you. Like, no, absolutely mm-hmm. not. I tend to take the perspective that different critiques are valuable insofar as they highlight certain issues, right? They're mm-hmm. situationally valuable. And
it's almost pragmatic.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm very pragmatic. I mean, I want to live in a more just world. I want to live in a world where there are fewer like social and material hierarchies. Like, that's sort of the bottom line here. I want to live in a world where there's less violence. And I think states are the major driver of violence in the world. And as a result, I tend to emphasize the anarchist critique, and I think it's very valuable to have this sort of big tent where different people are going to emphasize different theoretical frameworks where they're appropriate.
We're taking on a big project here, and we need your help.
We are restoring this beautiful, huge house built in 1878 and the 3 acres of land it's on.
We're doing it so that it can be a cooperative, communal space for people to live, work, create, and do activism.
We want to share income and resources and be a place where people can live and thrive no matter how much money they make.
There are many ways that you can help us, but the most mutually beneficial way is to subscribe to Solidarity House on Patreon.
Your subscription supports the effort to restore the house and the land, and it gets you access to tons of bonus material, including full unedited interviews, our original music, and more.
Please subscribe to Solidarity House and help us grow a commune out here.
And remember, you're getting 3 podcasts for the price of 1. Solidarity House, Solidarity Wyoming, and Cowboys on the Commons.
Yeehaw! We're Solidarity House on Patreon and Solidarity House Cooperative on Facebook and Twitter.